Welcome to Metacast. I'm Josh Anderson.
And I'm Bob Galen.
Today's topic is patterns of mature agile teams. It's a bit opposite of some of the talks we've had in the past, so we thought we'd try and bring it full circle and talk about some of the ways you can identify an agile team. Hopefully some of these will hit home and say, hey, look at us, we're mature, we're agile, we're awesome.
So what are one of your leading indicators, Josh, for like maturity in an agile team?
Actually, I was thinking about that today.
Were you?
On the drive over.
So I was thinking like walkers and canes.
Oh, well.
Do you think? Gray hair?
Yeah. I mean,
I have a little bit of gray hair, so.
But yeah.
Would you want a whole team of Bob Galens?
Would that? No, I would not. That would be the last thing I would ever want.
Oh, my God. Hey, good morning to you as well, sir. Can you imagine that? I'd be like fighting with myself.
I know.
You know that?
Actually,
I'd be arguing. It'd be entertaining.
It would be funny for like a day.
If you had like a glass wall around around the team or something.
Padded walls.
I'd kill myself, I think.
Oh, I know.
I would. It would be ugly. So maturity. So maybe not age maturity. I probably just, I'm going to get sued right there for
well,
crackling.
Well, I think, you know, if anybody can talk about age
that's
maturity,
true.
It's you,
that's
right?
thank you, Josh. That's true. So it's not essentially that. Experience? Does that come into play, do you think? Raw experience in Agile?
I mean, it would support speed of getting to that point, but not required for a mature team, I think.
I would tend to agree with you. What I'm trying to get on or off the table is sort of those traditional things of 20 years of experience, gray beards. It's not that there's anything wrong with those folks. They can be a member of the team, but it's not... When we say mature agile patterns, it's not necessarily around raw years of experience, raw technology stack experience, raw years of experience. Would you agree with that?
I concur wholeheartedly.
So what are you thinking about some of the attributes?
One of the things that I was thinking about was true collaboration with a product owner. Right, there's a lot of teams that work with their product owner, but sometimes revert to some old ways and will throw decisions over the wall of, well, that's the product owner's problem and they'll figure it out or they'll give us the priorities instead of helping that product owner and seeding them with potential priorities or doing some legwork up front and coming up with planning and setting it in front of the product owner and here, this is where we thought we'd start, what do you think, things like that. So that's one of the things when I see a team starting to truly partner with a product owner.
I like that one. I mean, that was sort of the essence. Remember that keynote I did a couple weeks ago at the Agile conference in Vegas? I did the essential qualities, or the title was Essentials of Product Ownership. And one of the things I was really emphasizing was the partnership between PO and the team. Now, my view was the PO needs to initiate that partnership, right? They need to take the time and stuff, but it's reciprocal. The team has to stretch out almost to the point where the roles are blended, where you don't think that statement you made earlier was telling, I'm going to do this to the product owner.
Right, yeah.
When you almost hear people talking about like the other side of a role and how they're going to just punt something to that person, you know that they're an immature team.
Yep.
Whereas if they don't talk about the role, I mean, they use PO, but I'm going to go pair with my product owner. We're going to sit down and do things together. You can tell that it's that partnership view. I think that it's true with developers and testers as well, right?
And I think the same thing goes for a Scrum Master, of not waiting around for a Scrum Master to lead a meeting or to initiate a discussion or to ask a difficult question, things like that. So I think trying to blur those lines, like you mentioned, across the roles within a team, and maybe sometimes we prevent teams from becoming as mature as we'd like by strictly defining those roles up front and really enforcing that. And
lately at work, I've been trying. So I'm not disagreeing with you, but I've been trying to re-emphasize the roles too. So I think there's this balancing act. I've been re-emphasizing the roles to remind the teams of like roles and responsibilities of who's, you know, if there's a gap, who's ultimately responsible, like for decision making. At the end of the day, the product owner is ultimately responsible for the decision-making of the product backlog, if you will.
Right.
And the team is ultimately responsible for the quality of the code.
Right, but I've seen that backfire a little bit where teams start to not take ownership and start to say, well, that's your problem, Joe, you know, as our product owner. You got to make that decision. Good luck. Right. You know, go get them.
Well, I've seen it backfire the other way, where the product owner feels like they have to acquiesce to the team for every decision, right? And then they want to generate consensus, and they get frozen because they can't generate consensus. So I think the tension between you and I on this point is valid. It's that balance, right? That you want that you want collaboration. You want that respectful collaboration of the team.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's tough. It's one of those balancing acts. There's no silver bullet. There's no 100% correct way. You have to find the fit that matches your team.
But you can smell it. I think you hit a good smell, right? I think it's... You can kind of smell when the team is level set, when the team is sort of mutually respecting each other and figuring... It's not about the roles. It's about getting stuff done. And they're figuring out how to do that. I mean, your Scrum Master example was, a good one. I've seen teams... So I'll give you two pictures. One is a team that's waiting for a Scrum Master who's late coming for a stand-up, and they do nothing. No, they're standing there and they're waiting, right? So they're standing there and they're waiting for the Scrum Master. So they're stuck in the role of the Scrum Master. Or they're in the middle of a stand-up and someone is rambling.
And no one calls them out.
And no one calls them out. And they're waiting for the Scrum Master to call them out. And, right. and you know, maybe the Scrum Master is thinking of something else or whatever. Then I've seen the flip of that is the Scrum Master's late. There's no big deal in the team. The team starts doing what? The daily stand-up. Why? Because it's for them. Right? And someone just naturally, it's sort of really beautiful when it happens. That someone naturally assumes the role, if you will, of the Scrum Master. It's not a big deal. Someone just starts facilitating, and the team starts running their stand-up. It's the same thing when someone's jabbering in a meeting or something, and the Scrum Master's not facilitating for whatever reason. As crisply as they could, and someone, I love it when I'm a Scrum Master and someone on the team, like call someone out. I just in the back of my mind, I smile every time after all these years. Every time a team member calls another team member out in an appropriate setting, if you will, in a ceremony, I smile in the back of my brain. It's like, cool. I appreciate that.
Right? Absolutely, I'm on that same page.
So I think that's one smell is that sort of that truly collaborative, you know, team, and then that partnership with the product owners.
So a good smell.
So two good smells there.
We never usually talk about good smells. It's always bad smells.
We do.
But we're doing good smells.
We whine a lot, don't we?
Well, you do.
True. I know I can whine. So there was two bundled smells in there. But truly product, you know, partnership between PO and the team. Then we generalized it to partnerships amongst the team, right? So that's some good smells there. And just that stepping up where it's appropriate. What else you got? What do you think?
Other fragrant smells?
Yes.
I think quality and really a relentless drive for quality. Refactoring or CI or any way to help them produce a better product. Now, teams will, right? Teams will find ways to do bits and pieces here, but a team where it's really ingrained in what they do and there's no option and refactoring is never questioned or automation is something that's just part of what they do. It's in their essence. Things like that.
I would jump on that bandwagon too. I mean, I think it's around the other part of it is quality isn't just testing in quality.
Right.
So you do inspections.
Right.
Right. You look at each other's code. You do write down some documents. You do review designs as a team. Right. They could be very agile designs. They could be very informal designs. But you do scrum around the design. You get at the whiteboard.
Yep.
A lot. You do a lot of whiteboard scratchings to get the team on board. You can see people popping up and down. So I think that would be a quality smell.
Right, and that's a very common new agile team. First thing they do is, woo, we don't design because we're agile.
Right.
Right, things like that. And that's not what it's about. It's about doing it when it's needed and not all up front or something like that.
And just enough of it, right? Yep. Just enough of it, but doing it. That's the point. I think that's the maturity point, is knowing that there's nothing wrong. Not only is there nothing wrong, there's a lot of things right with just doing design and doing it collaboratively as a team. So that's sort of, it's not test job for quality, it's the whole team's job.
Well, and I think that's a big key there is collaboration within the design. There's still a lot of teams that go off and the developers do the design and then hand it off. They don't involve the entire team in that product and that process. So I think that's a big key.
So how they do work too, you kind of went off on a slight tangent there, but I'm thinking about like collaboration on the real work itself. So it's taking quality, it's having quality part of your DNA. Elizabeth Hendrickson is this agile tester consultant, and she talks about being test infected in agile. That's her terminology, and she I think she even has a website like testinfected.com or something like that. And but I like the wording in the, and it's not the testers; it's the whole team becomes test infected. It's like everyone's job to just sort of write tests, write automation. She has a heavy skew towards automation,
right?
So it's really trying to automate at multiple levels, trying to get the team to just naturally do it, to not fight. So to me, it goes back to what you were saying. A lot of people argue, like, the trade-offs of quality. To me, a test-obsessed team is going to embrace it. So you're not going to get the pushback.
Right.
If anything, you're going to want to stop them from testing rather than start them from testing. Right. If you have any problem, it's that they might over-test.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I'd rather not even stop them.
Yeah, right. So here's a question to you. Can a truly mature agile team exist without automation?
That's a really good question, actually. I'm thinking, and I sound like that. You only ask one of those every year.
It's like, whoa, where did you come up with that? Who are you?
That's a really good question. I think you can. I mean, I think the core, if you look at the core of Agile, it's not a tools play, is it? It's a behavior play.
So isn't it hard to be...
I think it's hard.
Yeah.
It's harder. So is it impossible? That's what I'm arguing. Is it impossible to be Agile, to do a good job without automation? I don't think it's impossible to do that.
Right.
I think it's incredibly hard to do it. I mean, the proof is in the pudding. At iContact, I'm investing, and you know you're investing as well. I mean, you're relentlessly, I think, investing in automation. I do the same thing. There's a reason I do that. It's because it makes life easier. It makes feedback easier. The other part is it's a growing testing is sort of this growing. Rarely are you retiring code, unfortunately.
Right.
Maybe we could explore that as a mature smell, in that you erase code as much as you write code. Yeah. Right. But rarely is software development, from a maintenance perspective, a code diminishing proposition. It's normally a code growing proposition. So testers know that, and they're behind that. They know that over time, if they change nothing, they get behind. Right? If you don't add testers, the coverage is going down over time because the app is getting larger as people add features and functions to it. So the only way, one of the only ways to fight that, one way is to add testers, but rarely is that in the cards. So it's automation. How do you automate? How do you script anything? Even how do you reduce like setup time? So if it's not test automation itself, it's like database. If it takes you an hour to set up a database scenario in data, if you can write something, a script to do it in 5 minutes, you've now saved yourself 55 minutes of data setup time, right?
Right.
So things like that become sort of...
Well, that's the tough part is automation isn't just automated testing. So it's automated deployments, things, ways to get ready code to your testers as quickly as possible.
And to get them testing, right? To get them in a position or a position to reproduce,
right?
To your point, absolutely. Very often, it's sort of, I think it's a misconception out there. Folks look at automation as being totally a feature-driven thing where you're automating features, you're automating functionality. I don't know what the trade-off is, but I think there's a heck of a lot of opportunity in automating like deployments and data. And it's a missed opportunity because rarely do teams focus there. They're focusing on the functionality side, and they don't focus on the environmental side that much. I actually think the environmental place is the first place to go.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're looking at automation, where do you invest first to get time back?
Right.
I think there's some low-hanging fruit on the environment side.
Absolutely.
That you can get your investment back.
Yeah, we're huge on that, of a one-click deploy and wait 10 minutes.
Exactly. And you don't see that. It's sort of not obvious to a lot of teams. So I'm trying to keep a list of these things. So I think QA in your DNA would be one of those things. And truly QA in your DNA.
Right.
So collaborative as a team, not having to remind the team, not having to push, and getting no pushback, just getting the team. I love it when we get to the end of a sprint and the developers and testers and the team just figure out that they have to do some testing. And I don't have to tell people what to do. I don't have to remind the developers it's their job to pitch in for testing, right?
Yeah.
It just sort of naturally happens because people get it, that their job is shifting because of the nature of what the deployment is about to happen, right?
Mm-hmm.
What else you got?
What else do I have?
From your point of view.
From my
like
point
important,
of view?
Yeah, for like important patterns, that maturity patterns that you've seen.
That I've seen?
Yeah.
Maybe I haven't seen that many.
I beg to differ.
So, I mean,
in your shop, do you? I mean, you could be a patterner. You could be a smell yourself.
Wait a minute.
Did that come out right? I don't know if that came out right.
Oh, I'm sure it came out right from your view, not on my end. So
I put you on the spot maybe too much sometimes, Josh.
Yeah,
do you think I do that?
You're a jerk.
I'm a what?
What?
A jerk?
I didn't know.
Yeah.
No one said that.
So, one from my perspective is, and this is an active discussion I'm having at work nowadays, is trying to stretch. So doing more than you think is possible. So estimating, when you do estimates, stretching with your estimates. When you do sprint planning, putting more on the table. And again, I'm not trying to drive the team, so please don't misinterpret me. I'm not saying commit to more than you can do, but have the view that, you know, don't have a pessimist view all the time. I think so many teams have the ultimate pessimistic view. My God, you know, a hurricane's going to hit, and we're going to flood the entire building. So that's 3 days to do the cleanup of the mud and muck.
Right.
then I can start coding. No, the electricity's not out yet. Right. On yet, so I can't really code. I can't even think about a design yet because the whiteboards aren't white anymore.
Right.
So it ends up there. You know, it's 832 points
right.
for that work, and it's an incredibly a pessimistic view. And I'd like to hear more optimistic views sometimes. And I mean, you know, openly optimistic. Like, you know, you have some pessimistic views, you have some realistic, you have some optimistic. I'd like to see the teams try to stretch themselves.
Right.
I'd like velocity to not be consistent. I see some teams, we've talked about in Metacast before, I think a bad smell is a team that every sprint hits the same. They estimate 30 points, they hit 30 points.
Right.
Next sprint, hit 30 points. They do that for a year and a half. 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30, 30. What are they doing? They have a flat line. It is a beautiful curve, right? It is a beautiful delivery, tempo, heartbeat. But I think there's something inhumane about it. I'll call it lying. I'll call it misleading themselves going on in there. They can do more.
Complacency, right?
It's so complacency.
It's you get in the groove. It's easy. You know, that whole thing of going from good to great is a lot harder than going from bad to good. So that team got good, and they got good at being repetitive and being able to nail their estimates. And
so
the challenge that they're really nailing their estimates,
yep.
right? But they're delivering what they're promising, and
right.
that's all they're delivering.
Right. I suspect that permeates into even like they're testing what they think they should test. They're designing the way they think. So I suspect every activity in the team is sort of that complacent line, which is...
I bet the retrospectives are really boring.
They would be boring because you can't phenomenally challenge yourself because that would disrupt, you know, you might lose velocity. My
right.
God, you might fail a sprint, right? I would love it. See,
right.
I would love to see that sort of variation where in that team, one sprint you do 25, another sprint you do 40, a couple sprints you do 20s. You have this variation. I would look at that. I mean, again, it would cause me as a manager or as a leader a little difficulty in predicting.
Right.
But I would love that variation because it would say that the team isn't staying safe. They're risking things.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I think one of the patterns is that stretching pattern, that optimistic, so balance optimism, pessimism. Can do. Does attitude, what do you think? Does attitude come into play in agile teams?
Yeah, but then I think you have to have somebody to offset it, right? It can't be 100 people, or, I mean, you wouldn't have a scrum team of 100 people, but of 8-ish people that they can always do everything every time, no matter what. Right? They're going to burn out at some point. I think you need somebody with a realistic attitude to come in at some point and call them out on that a little bit.
So I don't understand what you're saying. So slow them down?
No, not slow them down, but...
Give them a vacation? I'm trying to understand what you're saying.
Yes, Bob. A vacation. A four-week vacation.
Cool.
Two sprints. Take it off. We got it.
So movies, snapshots in the retrospective.
Yeah. No, so what I'm arguing is that I'm huge on attitude within a team. But it's like you said, with views of pessimistic and optimistic and realistic, I think you need a balancing act right there, because there are times when you get overly optimistic and you end up putting yourself in a hole that becomes more difficult to dig out of. So one of those things might be you're halfway through a sprint and the burn down is not looking good, and like, we got it. We'll get it figured out. And they keep saying that, and they never get there.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I think there is this, but it's sort of what I'm alluding to is the overriding. I'm reading this book by Edward de Bono, I think is the author's name, and he talks, have you ever heard of six hats? He has six hats that you put on when you're looking at things. Like if you were reviewing a document, a requirement specification or a design, you put on the hat. So there's the optimist hat, there's the emotional hat, and they have colors. The black hat is the devil's advocate, for example, right? So, but you actually say, I'm putting on, instead of being perceived as a jerk because you're being a devil's advocate, or even instead of saying I'm the devil's advocate, it gives you this notion of you're putting on a hat to allow you to have a conversation. So I think every one of those hat perspectives adds value to what you're it sort of sharpens the solutions that you're dealing with. I think good teams. So maybe that's actually, we've sort of backed into that. That is, I think, a pattern of good teams, that they have that balance that we're talking about. That balance of what? Pessimism versus optimism.
Right.
That balance of attitude, can-do attitude versus reservation of making sure they're doing the right things.
Right.
Yeah. I would agree with that. So they have a hat. Using De Bono's term, and I don't remember what each of the hats mean.
They have a nice hat rack.
Well, there's a yellow hat, and it's the sunny, the person, the sunny day, right? Then the non-rainy, so the sunny day right. hat is the yellow hat, which is someone who's just constantly saying, yes, let's just do it, that's perfect, that's just, so no error handling in the sunny day hat, right? None whatsoever. In fact, in the sunny day hat, I don't think you'd have to test.
No.
Right, at all. But
you don't even have to write code. It'll
but
write
what
itself.
Would the sunny day hat do against the devil's advocate? You're going to get this yellow versus black thing going on, right? So at least someone, or if you notice that in a team meeting you had everyone had a black hat on, and you could say, you know what, we have no yellow in the room whatsoever.
So if everyone has a black hat on, wouldn't you have to put the black hat on to challenge the black hats?
So I'm glad to see that this analogy and this sharing I'm doing is actually making a difference.
It's like a double negative or something. It doesn't...
Sorry, forget the hats. I tried, John.
No, it was good. It was a good visual, and I agree with it. It's just one of those, it was like a paradox I was seeing.
Yeah. So I think it's interesting to get to shake out all the views from the teams. I think mature teams do that. So stretch.
Right.
So the ability to stretch and this healthy balance, I think, would be a mature indicator. What else you got?
What else I got?
There's one for me.
There's one from you?
Yeah, so what do you got for, what are you thinking about?
I think being able to just be honest and transparent about anything and everything. So this kind of circles back to some of the things we've talked about, of being honest with ourselves and with our teammates, of saying, you know what? Bob, I'm not sure we can do that. Or, Bob, we can do more. And being able to say that comfortably and not have people feel like they're attacked or that you're attacking or anything like that. And transparency within progress. How are we doing within the sprint? Having the metrics to support that. Of how's our burn down and how are we doing? Are we going to make it? We're 2 days behind, and what are we going to have to sacrifice? Things like that. Having those discussions openly and candidly is something that's a good smell.
I think it's also like defense. It's sort of vulnerable. There's this, the five dysfunctions. I think we've talked about that historically in the Metacast. And what the first one of the first is trust. I think you have to trust people to be transparent, and that's one of the first hurdles in transparency. Right. If I'm being transparent, I have to trust that people can handle the truth. I have to trust that they're going to appreciate what I'm sharing with them.
Right.
Right? I'm writing a blog post now on transparency. The question is, can you be too transparent? And I actually think you can be in an organization. You can be too transparent. And what I mean by that, what I've been observing, I'd be interested in seeing, in hearing your view, is that across the organization. So if you have one, let's say it's you, you're the development person, and there's the product person, and you're fully transparent from a development perspective,
right.
But product is opaque. So you're sharing your decisions, you're sharing your progress, you're sharing your pointage, etc. But the product is relatively opaque in why they're making the decisions, why they're making priority calls,
right.
Or something. I think that's so. I'm trying to create an unequal landscape, a clearly obvious unequal landscape. I think over time, that causes issues, right? I think it causes like frustrations and
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, it does. But I'm not sure that shutting down your transparency or pulling back on a little bit is really the right thing to do.
So I don't know if I said shut it down, like put up the blinds.
Well, I mean, if you're saying you're too transparent,
but what I'm saying, but it's, I think it, I wonder if it can.
I can't wait to comment on this.
I think it can be. Do you want me to? I'll copy you on it. I think it can be. I think it's the inequity that's the bad smell. I agree completely. And what would I rather do? What would I rather do is I'd rather have a relatively equal line of transparency across all functions in the organization. But what do you do if it's not there? And what if it causes morale issues, that unhealthy imbalance? You see what I'm getting at?
Right, okay.
Like we for example, do, and I need to couch this carefully, we do a release retrospective.
Mm-hmm.
So we do sprints, and then we do major releases. So we do monthly sprints and monthly deployments to production, but we're still on a quarterly market it to our customers' basis,
right?
And make a big bang out of it. We just did one of these quarterly. We just finished a quarter.
Mm-hmm.
We're about to do a release retrospective, which is for three sprints in a row, and it's company wide. So we open our doors and say, "Give us feedback."
Right.
We're the only organization that does that. And we get feedback. I mean, we get feedback from cross-functionals. Our marketing department gives us feedback. Our customer support people give us feedback. So that's the good news.
Right.
The bad news is what? We're out there.
Right.
We're out there on the hairy edge of these are our problems. These are our good things. These are our problems. These are our challenges. What did we accomplish since the last release retrospective? You guys can clearly see that.
Right.
I'm proud of it. But there's also sometimes where it demoralizes the team because they feel like, oh, no one else. We're the only team, that has all of these issues. And I think to myself, well, if any other team exposed, did an internal retrospection
right.
like that, they would find
there
would be a balance. But no one else is doing that.
Well, but it's also part of that being comfortable in your own skin, one of those things, and that honesty can be difficult, and transparency can be difficult and potentially painful, but I think that a truly mature team can handle that.
Well, that comes back to mature. You brought us full circle, Josh.
Hey, look at that.
You did incredibly well there, sir. But it is. I think it is a maturity. And this is a human being. This isn't like an agile. I think it's thick skin. Mm-hmm. I think it's being able to handle the truth, being able to constructively look at it. But it's hard.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
It's hard because it's your baby, too. I mean, mm-hmm. you're putting in tremendous work to put out your software.
Mm-hmm.
There's tremendous professionalism. I do think that, and this is the essence of the blog post, I do think you need to equalize transparency. Now, I know which direction I'd rather go in,
right.
But I think if you stay imbalanced for a year or years or for long periods of time and it doesn't close the gap,
mm-hmm.
that you can actually create this unhealthy sort of system. So I'm personally, my brain is thinking at the moment that the better thing to do is not to totally close down your transparency, but move close to lessen the gap that there is. It's a healthier thing for your team. It sort of breaks my heart to say that, but I don't know.
It's tough. It's almost like you're admitting defeat a little bit.
Well, but I've seen the dysfunction that the other side, it creates this dysfunction, and you can't ignore the dysfunction either.
Yeah.
Right?
It's so a harsh reality.
Well, it is that. And again, I would prefer, I think the entire organization, that's why I like it when organizations go agile. from a maturity perspective, because they start, one of the first tenets then is transparency organizationally.
Right.
Right. Information radiators across the organization. Mm-hmm. So everyone should be exposing their work. Everyone, successes, failures, where are we? Telling the truth.
Right.
And not being afraid to tell the truth. Exposing their mistakes. Right. And that's sort of what I'm saying.
Yeah, so I think that potentially launches us, and we covered a little bit there, of measurements and metrics. And, you know, you don't want to, measurements and metrics are tough, right? Because there's always that theory of what you measure is what you'll get and things like that. So trying to keep it simple and effective, but having it there to support the team to make the right decisions. And that's one thing that I always push, is that it's not about the charts. It's not about, and I know that you do the same thing, is it's not about the burn down. It's not about the task boards. It's not about any of that stuff. It's about how those help foster the discussions that need to be had.
So what are mature agile metrics from your point of view? What would you measure? Forget all of the old stuff, like test cases per tester or bugs found per tester, right? Or lines of code written by developers. Those are old guard, very dysfunctional metrics.
So I measure our productivity and just our effectiveness as a team with two things. One is our velocity per sprint and number of external defects found. Because that, to me, that's the truest measure of quality, of how many defects are being found out in the wild. How many got past us, right? I'm not after average number of test cases found internally or regressions found internally. Those are all good things. You want to foster those. So to me, as a team that is infected with quality, the only thing that should really matter is, does a customer find something that we didn't?
And then do a root cause or something to figure out what can we do to prevent that.
Right.
So I measure escapes. We call them escapes.
Yeah.
So field escapes, we measure them as well. Every time we push production, we sample escapes for a period like 2 or 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of our key process. We call them KPIs, key process indicators of what we measure from a corporate metrics mm-hmm. perspective. And that's important for us. Then velocity, we do measure velocity. I don't know if that's a mature, key metric for us. Awareness of what our velocity is.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you do? I mean, is there something, is like 20 is bad and 30 is good? Or are you looking for increases over time?
We are looking for over the year that we average better than we did last year.
So you're looking for like sort of a net-net. If this agile stuff is working the way we should, and if we're sort of drinking the Kool-Aid, we should be improving over time.
Right, and that's tough, right? Because it's be asymptotic and all that stuff. But we're still relatively new in this process. We're only 3-ish years into it. And I'm not looking for drastic improvements year over year, maybe 10%. So we go from 20 to 22 points on average, something like that.
Okay.
But it's averages across the entire year. I don't ever get too panicky if our velocity drops for a month or anything like that. It's if we're trending down, right, then that's something that we as a team need to look at. It. What's going wrong? What are we missing? What are we stumbling on? Things like that. So to me, a trend of 3 is where I start to question things.
Okay. I mean, I measure velocity. It's like, is it a key metric? The key metric for us, and we don't do a great job of this, is like value produced.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of velocity, but it's velocity from a are we producing the highest priority features,
mm-hmm.
and are we delivering on priority and feature sets to customers? So it's related to velocity, but we sort of look at it through the lens of what prioritization as well. So you could have
how do you do that? Does each feature have a value?
We assign values to features, and we're getting better at that. And it's an artificial. It's a hand waving value, but it's a value nonetheless. So we pay attention to. So a team. What would be a way of saying this? So a team could have a velocity of 30 for a given sprint, but they could have moved down on the backlog and picked for a variety of healthy and unhealthy reasons, mm-hmm. actually, they could have moved down in value and picked lower priority things. Would you buy it?
Yeah.
To pack a sprint?
Mm-hmm.
Let's say they didn't, there were database centric tasks or stories at the top, and we actually didn't give them what? We didn't give them a database engineer. This would be a bad on you or I as a manager. So we didn't staff the team appropriately to do the higher priority stuff, but we threw it into their lap. They went low priority. So their velocity wouldn't change necessarily because they cherry pick stories that were applicable to their skill set. But from a value perspective, we let what? We let value on the table, right. If that makes sense, right?
Yeah,
we let value. And so we would try to measure that and indicate that was a lower value sprint.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's sort of relative to sprint planning and it's relative to the velocity.
Right.
So we try to keep our eye on that. Any other metrics? There's one that I'm thinking of. One key maturity metric. This is a quiz, Josh.
Oh, no.
I know.
This is not good.
There's another one. That. So we have the quality. So I think we have a good quality one.
Mm-hmm.
We have a good sort of performance delivery-oriented one. And there's another one.
The happiness quotient.
Oh, you rock this morning. And is that software happiness or is that people happiness?
People.
Yeah, you're right on, baby.
Watch out.
So the morale.
Yeah.
So I think you measure... I think the third one is measure the morale of the team.
You have a metric for that?
Yeah, we pay attention to it. We do a survey. I do a practices survey that's focused on not so much are you happy with the car you're driving,
mm-hmm.
or you know, are you happy with your spouse, because that would probably be a scattershot all over the
right.
place. But it's how happy are you with Agile? How happy are you that we're holding to quality, that we're learning, that we're holding to our values, etc. Do you feel like we allow you to fail? Is one of the questions, right?
Mm-hmm.
Are you allowed to fail without penalty and things like that? And it gives us data because some people perceive penalties that aren't there. One of the interesting things for us is there's no one circling the halls looking to cut people's heads off, but sometimes folks really perceive that I can't fail.
Right,
that they can't fail, and that there's someone lurking in the hallways or in the closets that's going to hurt them or something
yeah.
if they fail. So they're afraid of it, and it surfaces how well we're doing. Are we changing the culture or not with our leadership behavior? So the happiness quotient is something. How do you measure? Do you measure happiness?
Thumb in the air. No, it's trying to be in all the places and almost not be seen to. See the interactions within the team, so I don't have a hardcore metric.
You might try a survey.
Yeah,
I'm not.
Yeah, no, I mean that's exactly why I asked. I'm like,
yeah,
how are you measuring that?
We do
get ideas.
A lot of people actually in the community do surveys. I've also done like a Scrum Butt survey.
Mm-hmm.
So I've done surveys of the teams that are around the process itself, and how well do they think we're adhering to the process?
Mm-hmm.
So key like Scrum Butt principles and things mm-hmm. like that. And then we've done sort of the morale, the process, but also we've had the morale connections into
right.
it. It gives us some insights. We never are doing as well as I perceive that we're doing.
Right.
Right. We never, you know, and the team seems to be hard on itself in some areas, like asking for help and accepting mistakes and things like
mm-hmm.
that. They're much harder on themselves than I'd like. What else we got?
What else do we have?
How about anything on lean? I think lean principles come into play.
You do?
I think so. Like WIP. One of the things we measure, it's like we measure velocity. We've talked about this before. We measure WIP and we measure throughput. So I think a sign of a mature team is the team doesn't handle 10 stories at
right.
once. They handle fewer, you know, they handle 2 stories at once. They don't load up their queues. They don't have 28 things in play. They don't, you know... Everyone's not designing.
Right, and they focus on getting things done.
They focus on getting things done quickly and getting them into, you know, in lean and inventory.
Mm-hmm.
What are the lean principles? Architecture. You were saying this earlier in design.
Mm-hmm.
Like just in, they're comfortable with just in time.
Right.
And a lot of teams aren't comfortable with just in time. So what do you think? Have you seen, we don't talk about lean enough, I think.
No, I agree with all of those points. Those are things that as our teams have matured that we've become better at reducing work in progress and trying not to spread ourselves thin and reining back and focusing on how can we get these 3 things done as opposed to these 5 things almost done.
I think there'd be a side effect here. I was thinking to myself, like teams that actually pull work. You know, and we don't do this right. I mean, in some ways we're regressing, I think, in our planning. I was talking to the Scrum Masters yesterday, and they were saying that the teams are, like the product owners want to equate days to points. And I thought we grew beyond that. And then the team is sort of throwing FUD into their points.
and they're blaspheming their points and things like that. And we're not listening to Test, and Test is either acquiescing to the developers or they're doubling. You know, if a developer says a Test, their estimate is like 16. So you see these weird, you know, you see these weird patterns that are coming out in estimation and planning. And I think so the leanness of it, I think lean thinking and just worrying about flow and not worrying about so estimation so much, you know, is getting the fact that the estimates are just, and this is hard. I mean, I would say our contact teams right now are still missing the boat as far as understanding what estimates are and are not. They're there to just be guides, I think. Right. I don't know if you agree. But they're not there to, like, to pin our arms down or something, or to be afraid of, or to measure actuals against. You're giving me that look. I know you're going to disagree.
Well, it's one of those things where you and I are in a different world, right? I'm
on stuck Earth.
You are. Well, I am not.
Right? You were not on the Earth.
Yeah, no. We are stuck in 6-month release cycles, things like that, and large commitments organizationally to the field and to business and all that stuff. So there are times where even for me, estimates
matter.
Yeah, estimates get uncomfortable.
You don't look. He doesn't look comfortable, Metacasters.
No, I mean, we're going through one of those cycles right now, right? So we are going through one of those phases. We wrapped up a release about 6 months, nailed it. We're planning 6 months, and we're looking at the point where the plan might go to 9 months. And every time our plan gets bigger, I get more and more nervous because we're going to fail, and the bigger target you're aiming for, the more you're going to miss by, right? So I keep trying to rein in our release cycle to monthly, or I would be happy with quarterly, for heaven's sake, but the large commitments that we have to make can be intimidating, and the team feels that, right? So they aren't dumb, right? They know it trickles up, and commitments are made 3 and 4 levels above them based on things that they say and stuff like that. So it can be difficult and disconcerting to a team and managers even.
Well, and it can take a while too. We're doing some blitz planning now for our next. Like I just said, you and I are in the same. We have different tempos, but we just finished a quarterly release, and we're now doing blitz planning for our next release. And what I'm finding is folks, a lot of the teams, they still want to go into details. They want to do detailed spikes and detailed analysis before they're comfortable.
Right.
And really, blitz planning is a high-level-ish thing.
Yeah.
We're trying to shake out dependencies, and it's really hard for us to get, you know, the dependent teams are looking for all the information to actually commit to its dependencies. And they're not going to get that.
Right.
And so there's sort of all of that angst or that fear around it. So lean is in there?
What else is in there?
Are we done?
We're pretty close to done. I think we covered a fair amount. Enough for a cast. You got something you want to sneak in there?
How about retrospectives?
Well, to me, that was part of the honesty and the transparency of doing it within the team and yourself.
So, but I think it's laid the. I want to add something. I mean, it's laid the really, and you sort of touched on it earlier. I think that the teams lay the easy ones in the retrospective. It's like, how do you attack? You know, you can lay, you know, we're going to change 3x5 card colors. We're going to, you know, we're going to sprint plan in the morning as opposed to the afternoon.
Right.
We're going to change rooms. We'll do it in a different room. Those are all those easier. We made a huge adjustment. We're going to change rooms for and in the time of day for our sprint planning when we missed commitments for the last 3 sprints. So laying the really crucial things on the table, being honest with yourself, courageous. It's not just honesty, too. I think a lot of times teams know, but they don't want.
Right. Yeah.
No one wants to say it.
Yeah.
No one wants to say it, and so they know in their hearts. And then, since no one is saying it, they question themselves.
Yeah.
They question their gut. They question their senses, but their senses are right on. It's just like it's just sort of this, you know, it's like this game of chicken that they're playing. And I still see that with our teams, and I still see that with a lot of teams. It's like, get the hard things. You're responsible for improvement.
Right.
So retrospectives are there.
Agreed.
I want to wrap up with one thing.
Okay.
So I have this. So Metacasters, I want to share
This talk today is based on a PowerPoint presentation that I did a while back called Essential Patterns or Essential Maturity Patterns for Agile Teams. It has a list of like 16 patterns or something, and Josh and I are sort of mining a few of them, and we're sort of hashing them together, which mm-hmm. is fair game. And so one of those is saying no. So the power of saying no, the courage to say no, so stop the lying, mm-hmm. and things like that. So what do you?
Doesn't it go against your courage, or it takes courage to say no?
I think it takes courage to say no, right. And this would be you actually. So this goes up and down the line. So right. I'm throwing you a beach ball to say,
ooh, okay,
right? Yeah. Well, no, you just appeared under pressure a little while ago. You were like, oh my God, this is a serious time. Serious estimates, 9 months. Mm-hmm. I've got people circling my head, looking. You know, they're picking at my bones and my right. team, and you actually buffer this for the team. So why don't you know? What about saying no to yeah, something? Right, what about so, pushing back?
Right.
What?
So that's where I said it's getting to 9 months. I'm trying to bring it into 4 months or 5 months, things like that. Trying to find ways, creative ways to do two releases in this time frame as opposed to one.
Right.
Something like that. So those are the things that the team needs to do when it's going against your natural process, the things you've been doing, the agile principles that you've put in place. That's when you need to start saying no. And right, you can't just say no. Right, you have to say, well, here's how we can do it a different way, or here's how it can fit into our process.
But in some ways, you have to hold the line, right? Don't you? I mean, I think you have to hold the line.
Yeah.
So, I mean, your son. I want to hear you say, well, what are you going to get it to?
Right.
I heard 9 months. So what are you going to say no to? Are you going to get 2 4 months?
I'm trying to do anything. At
there
this
is
point
no try.
Time.
There is only.
Thank you, Yoda. Do or do not. Yeah.
There is only do or do not. Right. So what? It may sound like I'm putting you on your spot. This is we're at the microphone.
No,
it's not going to haul you back to work.
No. But you're doing things like, I'm not doing it, but you really are.
But where,
I know your tricks, Bob.
Where are you going to latch it? Where are you going to say, this is the way it is? Where are you going to be prescriptive, Josh? Do you have any feeling?
To me, it's on just raw scope, right? So that's what we're trying to figure out, is how big are all of these things that they're asking for? So we're in that phase where they ask for the world, right? And we're saying, well, here's how big everything is, and here's how we can fit it in, and all that stuff. So the release planning cycle that we're into. So everything is on the table. So now trying to rein it back in to reality.
So there's a couple things I'll react to. One, you have to jettison scope. So one challenge yeah. is you're going to have is how do you negotiate scope off the table?
Yeah, that's
that's probably happening. And that's not, you can influence that. That's the product owners and mm-hmm. your product leaders and your executives have to buy that. But so reinforcing that. So how do you drop things? How do you get to minimal marketable feature sets? How do you prioritize those things? Mm-hmm. And that's hard. And how do you put pressure back pressure? Because that will generate risk.
Right.
So that's an area. The other thing that you said is cycle time for the team. How do you reduce, so independent of the work, you know, the amount of work you have, how do you slice the team's delivery?
Right.
So you could be getting pushback from your architect saying, I need 3 months to build this, Josh.
Right.
Right, and you may be uncomfortable with that, and you have to put a line in the sand and say we're going to do a 2-week sprint, or whatever, and we're going to have end to end deliverables or something.
Yep.
So what are you're doing that stuff?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Is it? I mean, are you going to acquiesce? What's an area? I wanted to just sort of hear one area where you won't be pushed beyond.
I think it's just going to get down to release length. Right, we can't get to a point, and the casualty is going to be scope, and then beyond that, it's not just that we're going to cut a feature, or it might be how can we do parts of a feature so it's minimal marketable, things like that. So having those discussions with the team, of having the creative discussion of what can we do in a given time frame that isn't going to cause this feature to take 12 months or okay. something like that. So having those discussions with the team, with the product owner, all across the board.
I mean, one of the things I'll take you off the hook. I put you on the hook sometimes. I apologize.
Yes, you do.
I know. But I'm thinking, and I'm thinking to myself. There are these places where we say no. One of the areas. So I'll give you an example for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't won this battle yet. So I have an engineering manager who runs a support group for me. She runs a sort of a systems engineering group, that's a highly dependent group. Mm-hmm. A lot of our scrum teams have dependencies into her team. She has a tendency to overcommit to dependencies because they're, and her heart's in the right place, right? Because every dependency that she says no to is a feature that we can't do. So what typically or historically has happened is the teams, you know, teams overcommit. So what does that do to her team?
Right.
It just destroys her team. Yeah. And usually it's back-end loaded. So it even gets worse, right? So on a sprint basis or a release basis, the teams underestimate or they don't surface all of their dependencies. So they hammer into her team at the last... back-end loaded in the sprint, back-end loaded in the release, mm-hmm. and it's always an overcommit. So what happens to her is her refactoring, her improvement, any improvement stuff has always, she always trashes, she always plans on making the life better. So one of the things in her purview is CI, mm-hmm. our continuous integration. So what's happening is they always throw out CI improvement in lieu of what? Dependencies.
Right.
And what we want to do this time is what? Hold the line on the improvements, on the refactoring. So we have like a 40% of the sprint. We're going to hold the line on 40%.
But isn't part of that partnering with the product owner and making sure that that's prioritized appropriately?
But part of it is also, so yes, but part of it is also what? From my point of view, part of it is saying no. Right, and convincing her to say no, and she's really uncomfortable with that, so throwing my own body in front of her and saying no. I've actually had, believe it or not, I've had arguments with her. She doesn't want it. She's like, well, we can't say no. And I'm like, no, we're going to say no. No, we can't say no. I'm like, no, we're going to say no. We're not. But she's like, the business needs. I'm like, but our pattern is, I hope I'm making sense.
Yeah.
I think there are these places where saying no, it's not the word, but it's holding the line.
Right.
Due to your values and due to your principles. Is what I think is sort of a differentiator for mature teams,
mm-hmm.
And it's not the team itself. I think that pattern is probably, it's team based, but it's also leadership based, right? And it's.
So you want the team to be infused with that same ownership.
Eventually, I would hope so, right? But it's really hard. It's hard. I think it's incredibly. This is an area where I don't know if teams. I think this is a differentiator for leadership. Because I don't know if teams can go there very comfortably. What I'm finding is saying no is one of the scariest things. Like this young lady, I'm not sure when she'll get there.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I'm... Mm-hmm. And when would she get there and she can hold the line?
Right.
I think almost any of our executives could come up to her, she would say no, and after like 5 minutes of probing, she would crumble. Mm-hmm. And it's not... That's not shame on her. That's actually shame on our culture. So you need that defender to defend the team, I think.
Right.
I would like it if the team got there, but I think...
So I think the team would do small no's, right? They're going to do big no's.
The team does small no's, but I think you need like the Green Lantern or something like that to be like defending the team.
Wow.
So that's maybe that's the leadership job of you or I.
Wow.
Metacasters, I think we beat this horse pretty much to death, Josh. What do you think?
I concur, sir.
All right.
We have.
So where can folks find us?
They can find us on the internet. They can find us at...
Yes, well, they can find us in beautiful downtown Cary.
They could.
Right at this moment.
Right at this moment. Hurry. Fast.
We're not going to be here for very long.
Right.
We have work to do.
So we are at metacast.com. That's with a hyphen between meta and cast. On Twitter, meta-cast, all spelled out. And we're on iTunes. Search for Metacast with a hyphen, search for Josh Anderson, search for Bob Galen. One of those three, you'll find us. Subscribe.
So we're open to ideas. We're open. Drop us comments on past Metacasts. Drop us comments on for future ideas. Where are we going to be? I'm going to be at Agile.
Ooh.
Agile 2011 in
be.
Salt
I'm
Lake City.
On that.
Everyone, every Metacaster who's listening to this, please light a candle for Josh. He's trying to get to he's trying to get to the actual conference, and he's meeting resistance, and he's not saying no. Just I'm wanting to go. He's not boldly going there yet. So light a candle and have a thought for Josh, and hopefully we can go there. If we can both get there together, we're going to do some Metacasts.
We should do Hands Across America. We
can do Hands Across America. But if we get there, in all seriousness, we're going to do some live Metacasts from Agile, maybe try to bring in some guest speakers.
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to it if Mr. Anderson can...
Oh, yeah. put it all on me, so that way I'm the bad guy if I don't get there.
I'm just trying to motivate you, Josh. Yeah. Yeah, it's that football thing. I'm sure someone in the line, you know, historically is and you responded accordingly. So, other than that, I want to just thank you. Thank you for listening. I hope you got something out of it. Get us your feedback. And for now, shake
and bake.
Take care, everyone.
See ya. No y'all for you.
No, I skipped the y'all.